Yeah, I'm currently a PhD student at ICFO in Barcelona, but this talk is based on work I did in Ekoki in Vienna, where I spent a few months doing an internship. So this is another way of looking at causality. It's called the process matrix formalism. So I'm just going to give an introduction to that formalism and then just some brief results that we have. And this is the structure of the talk, so emphasis on the first one. Okay, and I'm going to start very, very vaguely and broadly with what is causality, what we normally consider as causality anyway. There's some technical definitions, but we don't need to get into that. Just at its basis, it's something causes another. And in general, we think if something has caused something else, the thing that is being caused happens in the future of the thing that has caused it. And this is a fundamental idea, not just physics, to all of science. And so what we want, this is just kind of an example of this idea. So the causal structures we're used to seeing in day-to-day life are very limited. So if we have two events in this silly graph, we have a person sneezes and someone drops a bag of flour. So we could have that a person sneezes first, and then the noise of that scares the other person, drop a bag of flour. So that's that causal relation. We could also have someone drops a bag of flour and it goes everywhere, explodes, makes the person sneeze in principle. Or we could also have these things happen independently, different rooms, they didn't cause each other. But you know, in our day-to-day life, we don't think there's any other possible structures that we can have. And so what the idea that we wanted to explore is that this causal order that we do see in everyday life, is this a fundamental thing? Is this something that holds even at the smallest level of quantum, or is it an emergent property? And so I'm going to formalize a bit what I mean by causal order and causal structure. So a causal structure like this space-time light cone that we're used to, it's just a way of being able to say, given different events, that there's a partial order between them, which means that one can have an influence on the other, or can cause it, or can signal to it, all equivalent things. And so in this example, which we're used to, we have that because G is in the causal future of F, F can influence G and can signal to it. E can influence F. Because F can signal to G, this means G can't signal to F, and then vice versa, or similarly, F can't signal to E. And we also have, because H is outside the light cone of F, they can't signal to each other, which is given by that notation. And we also know that it is transitive. So E, because E can signal to F, F to G, E can indirectly signal to G. So that's just the general idea of what causal order is. And so we want to know what happens if we relax some of these assumptions in some cases. So the idea of conservative causality means that, say we have, this is Alice and Bob in their labs, these labs are isolated, and they should just in principle see regular quantum mechanics happen in their lab. But we want to know what happens if locally everything has regular causal order, but we assume that they're not embedded in a global causal order that follows these rules. So we're assuming, or we're not assuming, that we can make any statement at all about, you know, does something that happens with Alice happen before or after Bob, or can they influence each other? We're just saying causality, causal order applies locally, and we don't know what happens in the middle between them on the bigger scale. And so the assumptions we use here is that the laboratories are closed, and this means that they can't do any classical signaling to each other, and they don't get any other input from anyone, with one exception, which is that a quantum state will enter the system exactly once, and later they will let the quantum system leave their lab. But apart from that, there's no connection at all with the outside world. And our other assumption with this framework is called free choice, and that means that if they generate any classical bits within their lab, they flip a coin, they want to get some extra variable, we assume that that's just genuinely random, nothing else is influencing that. So this just shows that causal order holds locally, that's around Alice's lab, she should see everything working as normal, but we want to know what kind of processes are possible then if we relax the global causal order assumption. And so just to show what I mean by a process, that just means what happens to take the quantum systems to Alice and Bob's lab and what happens after they leave the labs. So here, this is an exhaustive list of the quantum processes that are allowed by global causal order. So we can have a quantum state, one part of, say, an entangled state enters each of their labs, or we could have a quantum channel so that once Alice has done her whatever she wants with the system and the system leaves her lab, it enters a channel and travels into Bob's lab and becomes that input. So that is allowed because they both have a system entering their lab. And the most general case is where both of these things happen at the same time. So we could have a part of a quantum system entering both of their labs, but the part that leaves Alice's lab combines with this other part of the entangled state and they enter Bob's lab. And this is called a channel with memory. So you get both effects there. But yes, so if you assume global causal order, this is the only situations that we can have. So we want to know then, if we relax that assumption, can we get different processes apart from these? And so this is where the idea of a process matrix comes in. It's just what we use to describe the things that go into the labs and what happens to the things that leave the lab. And so in this way, because the process matrix, you know, it'll determine what enters the lab and what happens when they leave. It's generalizing the role of both a quantum system and a quantum channel simultaneously. So it has both roles. And just references this paper here, this is what introduced the formalism and yes, and some of the later slides will also reference that. And so to define it more formally, what is a process matrix? We define it implicitly because you want to think of, given a particular process that happens, and then Alice and Bob generating their own bits, we want to know what kind of probability distributions can we get from such a scenario. So we have this implicit definition where that's the probability that Alice and Bob will output the classical variables X and Y, given that they, you know, flipped a coin and got A and B. And so this is the technical definition. So the W is embedded in there. It's an implicit definition. And we want to know, you know, what kind of Ws can we have that are allowed by just the most minimal assumptions of probability theory. So what I mean is we will have some constraints on W because of this definition. And that is because we need the probabilities to be non-negative and we need them to be normalized. So all of them will sum to one, given all possible inputs. And so these constraints, which is the only two constraints we put on these processes, they constrain the kind of processes we can have. So the first one is that if you assume that the probabilities, each of them has to be non-negative, you must have then that the process matrix W is positive semi-definite. What this means is that all of its eigenvalues are non-negative. And then the assumption of normalized probabilities, where they all sum to one, this gives us a restriction in terms of the types of terms we can have within the process matrix. And I'll explain this. Is that all right? So types of terms that are not allowed in W because of these constraints. If you break down the process matrix W into its different components, we see that we don't get any terms of this kind that represent these scenarios. First one would be where the system can output Alice's lab, come back around and influence what the input is. So this we call this backwards in time signaling. So this would give us a logical contradiction. But the probability constraints mean that we don't have terms of this kind. And similarly, we don't have any global causal loops where there's just no overall inputs, no overall inputs. They're just influencing each other kind of eternally there. So these will both give us logical contradictions, but the normalization constraint means that these terms can't appear. So note that we're not actually enforcing in principle that we can't have terms like this. It just naturally falls out of the minimal assumptions that we have about probabilities. Probably more importantly is what terms can we have in the process matrix. So maybe disappointingly, it turns out that we can only have terms of this kind where each term follows causal order, the terms that we've described earlier. But the interesting thing is that we can have a linear combination of these terms. So we could have a process matrix that's a linear combination of terms where you have A to B signaling and the reverse where it's B to A signaling. And so we want to know, given that it's a linear combination of unidirectional signaling in different directions, does this mean this violates causal order or not? So the answer to that is that depends. So because there's a particular class of process matrix called a causally separable process matrix. And this is given by this definition here. What this basically means is that the process matrix is a classical mixture of two different matrices, one of which is only Bob to Alice signaling. So there's no Alice to Bob in this case, and one of which there's no Bob to Alice in this case. And so it's non-trivial to see, given a particular process matrix, if it is of this category. And the reason for that is, if we look at this Venn diagram, so the whole set meant to represent causally separable process matrices. So that's where you would have a linear combination of the purple circle and this kind of peach circle. But you do have terms that are no signaling terms. There's no signaling happening, and they belong in actually each of these categories. So it's not unique how you can decompose a particular process matrix into this form. So this just means that given if I give you a process matrix, you can see the terms. It's not that easy to see if it's causally separable or not. Just to make this idea a bit clearer, what I mean by causally separable, the kind of process matrix I showed you there, where it's a classical mixture of process matrices with one directional signaling, it's as if that you had a classical switch, which with a certain probability P would let you have signaling from Alice to Bob, and a certain probability 1 minus P gives you Bob to Alice signaling. So in a given run of an experiment, you only have one of these things happening, but it's just that the process matrix would describe, you know, the average statistics. Then on average, then you do have a mix of the different terms, but it doesn't actually violate global causal order. So this brings us to then, are there process matrices that do violate global causal order? And the answer is yes. But as I said before, it is difficult to prove it just from looking at the terms. So there's a more interesting way that gives more insight then, that you can prove that you have a process that violates global causal order, and that's using a causal game. So this is an analogy with the kind of Bell games to prove non-locality. You can create a causal game that can only be, it can be won with a greater probability than a particular limit that you get, only if you have a process that violates global causal order. So for example, this is called the OCB game. So you have Alice and Bob in their labs, and you have each of them flips a coin to get the classical input A and B, and each of them will output a classical variable X and Y. And so what they're trying to do is they're trying to guess each other's inputs. They're trying to guess, Alice wants to guess what Bob flipped, and vice versa. But there's an extra coin flip happening as well on Bob's side, so this makes it uneven. And this coin flip B prime will determine which of their guesses matters in each run of the experiment. So it's a little bit convoluted, but it just means that if B prime is zero, this means Alice's guess counts. So we want that X, which was her output, is equal to B, which is Bob's coin flip. And similarly, when B prime is one, you want Bob's guess to be correct. You want Y to be equal to A. And so it's been proven then that this game, if you have a process that does not violate global causal order, then the maximum probability of success you can have is 3/4. And so we can kind of get an idea of this because we can think intuitively the best way you could win this would be to have one-way signaling in the right direction. So to have Alice able to just signal directly to Bob and encode in her process, encode in her system what, you know, her bit was. And that means that if it's her that's guessing, or if it's Bob that's guessing in this case, that means he'll get 100% right because he has the process there. But because we have this B prime that introduces this unpredictability, that means then if it's the other direction and it's Alice that has to guess, but she's output her system, she just has to guess 50-50. She has no idea what is when is. So this way we'll have 3/4 of probability overall that they will succeed with the game. So we're looking for then a process matrix that would allow us to violate that inequality. And here is an example here. It's called the OCB matrix, based on the authors that introduced it. And it's of this form where that's just terms that from signal from A to B, in terms of signals from B to A. And so there's a particular procedure then that allows them to violate it. So because of the structure of the process matrix, Bob then has the opportunity to measure the system that comes into him. And if he measures in X, it creates a noisy channel from him to Alice. And if he measures in Z, it creates a noisy channel from Alice to him. So, and because he's the one that's flipping the prime, he wants to determine, you know, the direction of the signaling. So it's a noisy channel, so it's not going to be 100% probability of getting it right, but it does give you a higher probability of success than with the causally separable process matrices. So this is an example of a process that is allowed by quantum mechanics and is allowed by basic probability theory that violates a causal inequality. And it thereby proves then that this particular process matrix is causally non-separable. Okay, so that's the introduction over, and I'm just talking about some preliminary research that I've done, and it's based on the idea of the positivity constraints that I mentioned earlier, because positive probabilities, we need all the process matrices to be positive semi-definite. So this can be a bit tricky to enforce in practice. So we just chose a particular kind, particular class of process matrices. So remembering that this is the OCB matrix, and it was just an equal combination of A to B signaling terms and B to A signaling terms. We just generalized this by replacing that 1 over square root 2 with a P for the A to B signaling term, and a Q for the B to A signaling term. And what we want to know is what are the values of P and Q for which this is positive. And we have extra constraints in this because these signaling terms, we assume them to be normalized. So the highest eigenvalue is 1, and we assume that they kind of commute on 3 qubits, which is a rough way of saying their eigenbasis is the same for 3 of the qubits. And so what's the good thing about using a process of this kind is these processes, like the OCB matrix, they don't have any non-signaling terms. So that means when you're trying to see a particular process is causally separable or not, you don't have these extra terms in the way that you're trying to see which category that you could put them into. So we can get very directly a region in P and Q space. And if the P and Q values are inside this region and it's a positive process matrix, then you will have a causally separable process matrix. And if it's outside of it, it's causally non-separable. So this is just looking at the causally separable region, but then we have to look at the positivity region then for the processes to see if they are valid. And so, yeah, this is just what our positivity condition is then, just meaning that that has to be positive. And I define two values now. I define capital lambda is the smallest eigenvalue of A to B signaling term. And then C0 is the largest overlap you can get between the eigenbases of signaling terms as well. And it turns out that you can find your positivity conditions based only on these two variables. And so it turns out to be the overlap of 4 conic sections. These are ellipses, parabolas, or hyperbolas, depending on the value of these variables. So you have to find 4 conic sections in P and Q space and find the overlap between all of them. And that is the region in which these process matrices are defined and positive. So I'll show you some examples of these. So this would be the case where you have elliptic constraints. And so what I mean by having 4 conic sections, it just means that you have 4 separate conditions that you have to enforce, conditions in P and Q. And these conditions take the form of an ellipse. So that's each condition separately. But then because we have to apply all the conditions together, we find that the positivity region is the overlap of all of these. So it's bounded within that black line. And this is just a close-up of this region here, where we can see inside that's the causally separable region. And we have some causally non-separable parts here as well. So we find in every case that the causally separable region is positive. So every we expect this really because every process that you can do that is causally separable, it is, you know, follows regular causal order. We expect to be able to do them. So it makes sense that they are positive. But the interesting thing is we find in every case, apart from one, that we do have an extra causally non-separable region as well. And so this case here, this is the OCB matrix case because it's a special case here and we have the circle. We find that actually the OCB matrix, which is the one that violates the causal inequality I mentioned earlier, it exists at the boundary of the positivity region. And this is just another proof, if we needed it, that it's a causally non-separable process because it's not inside that purple region. And so just show you some more examples. So this is a case where there are hyperbolic constraints, but the similar thing applies. And you can see sometimes the causally non-separable region is very small, and sometimes it's larger, but it always exists, except in one particular case, which is in this case. These are my parabolic constraints. In this particular case, we have, remembering that C0 was the overlap between the eigenbases of the A to B signaling term and the B to A signaling term. We have in this case, the overlap is one. So these signaling terms have the same structure, basically. And in this case, the only positive process matrices we can have are causally separable. We can't get the non-separable ones. So this kind of suggests roughly that something about the non-commutativity of the signaling terms, the fact they're not the same kind of signaling, is what gives us causally non-separable process matrices. This is just the same thing again, that we see that all the causally ordered ones, all the causally separable process matrices are allowed by positivity. And that when there is non-commutativity between the signaling terms, there are always some causally non-separable processes. So just an overall quick summary here, which is that, the important thing to take from this is that quantum mechanics with minimal assumptions based on the probability, it does not immediately rule out processes that do violate global causal order because of the fact that this OCB matrix exists. So we would have to think of if there are more conditions that we should apply to it to think, is this a physical process or not? But at the absolute basic level, quantum mechanics and probability doesn't rule them out. And then we've shown these processes can have an advantage in certain tasks, such as the causal game that I showed you. And then our own result is that the non-commutativity between signaling terms suggests a link between that and causal non-separability. Thank you.
I'm trying to understand, does this feel a bit more general than the whole DAC problems in the video I'm talking about? Maybe because in the DAC problems, basically, you cannot have certain angles of possibility. Is that true, or is that how it relates to the DAC problems?
You're right to say it's more general because we just don't make any assumptions. So with the DAG formalism, it does have the a priori assumption that you do go in one direction only, that you do rule out the grandfather paradox. But in this case, I guess you could say it's a bit of a different journey to get there because we start with minimal assumptions, but then the constraints mean that we also don't get these paradoxes too. So the two formalisms, they can kind of work side by side.
Other quick question. Oh, sorry. If anybody else wants to, I can. Okay, I just wanted to understand a little better what is the causal separability.
Mm-hmm.
Because you say anyway you have a linear combination of terms that are causally ordered.
Yeah.
So this is also true, always true. Like it's not a weird thing. It's just a linear combination.
Yeah.
But still, it could be causally non-separable. What does that mean?
Yeah, exactly. So in general, you have a linear combination, but it could be that they're only one-way signaling or they have only terms that are non-signaling, but you could also have a linear combination of terms that are signaling in different directions. So a priori, this doesn't tell you that that it's going to violate global causal order because of the fact that we can have, remember the picture with the classical switch, and it brings you to one or the other signaling. So that kind of scenario also explains why you would have a linear combination of different signaling terms. And that's a completely that kind of normal situation where you have global causal order. So the very presence of signaling terms in different directions in the process matrix isn't enough to say that it's causally non-separable. You have to actually either analytically show that there's no way to decompose that process matrix into a combination of two that are one-way signaling, or else violate a causal inequality. That's probably the best way to show that it's definitely causally non-separable, because no causally separate process could violate that inequality. That answer your question?
Yeah, so causally separable means that there's just one way of causation? No.
Oh, no, sorry, I'll go back to the... Causally separable means this, basically. Means that...
okay.
And this, you know, P could be one even. Causally separable is the most general way of describing ones that don't violate global causal order. So this is another category of things that doesn't violate global causal order. So anything causally separable can be deconstructed into this kind of form. If these terms could be more general, it could be, you know, the channel with the memory, but I just mean that these are A to B, and these are B to A.
And when you go back to WOCB,
I think I see your question. So WOCB, it does have a linear combination of terms, but the important thing is with the definition of causal separability is that these are also process matrices. They're not just terms or a collection of terms. They have to have the same normalization and things. Yeah, that's a good point. Thank you.
Okay, if there are more questions, chat now. Thanks. Thank you, Lila, again.